Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 5th, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the administrative state and federal government. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. They're both going to give opening remarks of about 10 minutes. Then we'll have a little bit of back and forth, but as always, turning to you, the audience, for your questions. We're going to begin with Philip K. Howard. He's Senior Counsel at Covington & Burling and Chair of Common Good. His opening remarks will be followed by J. Kennerly Davis, Jr., the former Deputy Attorney General for Virginia. But with that, the floor is yours, Mr. Howard.
Thanks so much, Dean. Well, the topic for today is whether bureaucracy is a necessary evil or just evil. And I'm coming down on the side that it's generally evil, not because of overregulation, but because modern bureaucracy has precluded and replaced sensible choices at the point at which decisions are made, and it makes it so that nothing works. There's no common sense. So in general, bureaucracy is the implementing mechanism of the regulatory state, and some part of it is obviously essential. And the way it works, as we know, is that rules and procedures must be complied with before something is done, whether it's to get a permit, discipline a student, the paperwork showing that you've complied with worker safety rules or nursing home rules or honored someone's privacy or the like. In general, though, if you're evaluating that, you'd say, well, how does it support our freedom in a free society? And law supports freedom by protecting people against bad things, no crimes, no pollution, no cheating on contracts, that sort of thing. But our concept of the rule of law has changed since the 1960s. We woke up to lots of abuses of racism, pollution, lies about the Vietnam War and such. And we not only changed our values, which was important to do, but we also created an extremely prescriptive concept of the rule of law, where law not only set goals and principles and also some rules, but also affirmatively aspired to replace human choice at the point of legal implementation. The CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, is now 175,000 pages. After World War II, it was about 10,000 pages. The Constitution is 15 pages and includes very important concepts in three or four words, like unreasonable searches and seizures, the new Volcker Rule implementing one part of the Dodd-Frank Financial Regulation Act is 950 pages long. And all this specificity is generally counterproductive and in many ways evil. It doesn't leave room for the complexity in life situations, doesn't let people ask at the point of implementation, what's the right thing to do here? The idea of it is, the myth of it is that the law is clear, but of course, when you've got a 950-page Volcker Rule, it's not clear, it's completely incoherent. Nobody can know it, and it becomes this elaborate labyrinth, which gives a lot of work to law firms like mine. But doesn't necessarily make it clearer to people supposed to abide by it. And another idea is that this specificity avoids arbitrary decisions by government, so you protect against government power. But one of the ironies, and I've written books about this, is that no one can comply with all this law. There's just too many rules. Even take something as simple as a nursing home, there'll be 1,000 rules for a nursing home. How many centimeters above the floor the food can be stored? There'll be 0.09 recreational workers per resident and such. And then paperwork to prove that you've done all that, and no one ever complies. And inspectors don't even know all the rules. They just come and enforce the same so small subsection that they know. So it doesn't protect us against arbitrary authority. If anything, it gives inspectors much more arbitrary authority. And then finally, it doesn't really align with our regulatory goals. There are huge opportunity costs for people spending all their money, all their time and money, with their, you know, with their noses in rule books. So Common Good recently did a report on infrastructure approvals, and we found that lengthy environmental review, ironically, is dramatically harmful to the environment because it prolongs bottlenecks. When you spend that much time trying to overturn every pebble instead of focusing on what the important environmental issues are, you end up hurting the environment because no one's using their judgment about what's important. There's clearly a role for rules, speed limits. There are complicated areas where you need checklists to make sure a terrible tragedy doesn't happen, effluent guidelines and pollution. But for anything that's really complex and involves trade-offs, rules are generally counterproductive. So we've created this massive, dense bureaucratic state with, in the federal government alone, almost 150 million words of binding law and regulation, most of which is highly prescriptive. And the question on the table is this enhancing our freedom? This law is what law is supposed to do, or is it not? And because of the rigidity of the bureaucratic and density of these bureaucratic structures, it is not enhancing our freedom. It is not even enhancing our public goals. And for that reason, I think it's evil.
Very good. Ken Davis.
Thank you, Dean. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to participate in this call this afternoon, especially with Philip Howard, who has written so extensively and constructively on this important subject, most recently in the Saturday edition of the Wall Street Journal. I agree with much of what Philip has to say. Certainly his description of the situation, the cost of it, the delays created by the complex web of interlocking and overlapping and inconsistent and ambiguous and conflicting rules, the lack of individual regulator accountability, the check-the-box compliance kind of mindset that it all breeds, and the stifling of common sense and the suppression of opportunities for judgment and invention and initiative, and because of all of that, the limitations on individuals' abilities to take and exercise, take authority and take responsibility and exercise their judgment to do the right thing when they do the wrong thing, it's very difficult to hold them accountable. I agree that over the decades, the recent decades, our concept of the rule of law has changed from one that focused on a limited number of prescriptive rules, prohibiting X, prohibiting Y, and otherwise leaving individual citizens free to act and live and make their decisions within broad, open spaces defined by those proscriptive laws. And that's evolved into a prescriptive regime where it's not a question of a few things being prohibited and you're being left alone to exercise your liberty as you see fit, but a prescriptive system in which the things that you are allowed to do are pursuant to the prescriptive directions of micromanaging means and methods, regulations and regulators. I agree with all of that. And it's certainly not only contrary to traditional concepts of freedom, it is terribly harmful to the effective workings of our society and our economy, and suppresses the growth in the economy that we need to not only fund our public goals, but to simply pay our national debt and obligations. Where I differ, though, and I'm thinking now not just of Philip's opening remarks, but of his writings, is where we should look to, or where regulatory reform needs to look to, if the goal is to restore opportunities for personal judgment, the assumption of responsibility, exercise of common sense and decision making, and the acceptance of responsibility for the consequences of those decisions. Who needs more freedom and more flexibility? Philip's writings, his books, the most recent being The Rule of Nobody, after examining and I think correctly describing the situation, the regulatory morass that we find ourselves in, he says the regulator is the one who needs more freedom to effectively administer broadly defined rules, and more freedom to bring discretion, personal, professional discretion to bear on particular facts and circumstances, to give direction to the regulated party and to determine on a case-by-case basis when the regulated party has violated the broadly defined principle. I differ here. It's not that the regulator needs more flexibility to make our system work better. It is the regulated individual that needs more freedom and more flexibility to exercise his or her judgment and organize their affairs and pursue their, if you will, pursue their happiness. Philip is quite right that our concept of the rule of law has changed from proscriptive, limited rules promulgated and administered and executed by a limited government to a prescriptive, overhanging, overbearing administrative state. But it's the individual, not the administrator, who needs freedom. Our traditional concepts of natural rights, limited government, rule of law as conceived primarily as a mechanism for the restraint of arbitrary discretionary state power, those principles are what we need to return to and try to reinvigorate and rein in, if you will, the administrative state. Thank you.
Very good. I want to give Mr. Howard a chance to respond. But before we do that, let's open the floor to questions and people can begin queuing up to the extent you have questions. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our callers, let me give Mr. Howard a chance to respond.
Well, I guess my response would be that it's like a law of physics. You can't let the citizen exercise his common sense unless the official also exercises his common sense, not to do whatever they want, but, I mean, just for example, there are all these rules about how to run a classroom. Well, if the teacher isn't free to exercise her judgment about who's misbehaving, then, and you have to go through an elaborate legal procedure to prove who's misbehaving, all that kind of stuff, the students will read that instantly, and pretty soon the teacher has no authority, and none of the kids are free to learn because the teacher wasn't free to do what was really obvious. In infrastructure, which is an area we've been working on, I think environmental review is really important, but it's stupid to have it be bad for the environment. So how do you decide? There's no rule that says in advance how much environmental review is needed. It depends on the situation. And you probably can't have a rule that says just let the developer do whatever they think is right either. So we've proposed that the chair of the Council of Environmental Quality, which is part of the White House, a position created by the National Environmental Policy Act, should have the job, the responsibility of saying how much environmental review is required. That doesn't mean that that person will do a good job, but at least gives them the chance to do a good job. And today, it's like the rule is the worst possible job because everybody studies everything up the wazoo until 10 years have passed. And in one case I studied, which had virtually no environmental impact, the environmental review statement was 20,000 pages long. So just one more example. Australia changed their nursing home. They got rid of 1,000 rules and back in the late 80s because their nursing homes were terrible. And someone had the bright idea of replacing them with 31 general principles. Have a home-like setting, respect the dignity of the residents. Kind of looks like the Constitution, you know, their general principles. Within a year, and the experts scoffed. They said this is gonna, these nursing home operators would get away with murder. Within a year, and this proves Ken's point about the need for freedom, the nursing homes were twice as good. They were much better because people were free. But they weren't free to do whatever they wanted. And so the regulator, I suppose, arguably had more authority because now you could argue about what's a home-like setting. But in fact, in my world, the regulator never has complete authority. It always has to answer to supervisors and ultimately to courts. So what happened in Australia is that both sides might differ on what's a home-like setting, but when they're disagreeing, they're arguing over right and wrong, you know, what's good and what's not. Whereas today what happens is you still get disagreements between regulators and business, but they're arguing over the meaning of Section 526B23, you know, which has nothing to do with right and wrong. So I just don't think there's a world in which you can create a language that somehow liberates citizens while shackling officials. If the president doesn't have authority to approve the infrastructure, then, you know, it's just not going to get built on a timely basis. So, you know, but I'm not arguing for unfettered discretion. I'm arguing for the kind of arguments you have over constitutional principles, applying it to schools and nursing homes and the like.
Very good. I do want to get Ken Davis a chance to speak again. We've got two questions pending, and we'll get to those questions in a moment. But Mr. Davis, do you have a thought before we turn to the audience?
Yes. I'm certainly not suggesting that when the administrative state be as I said, reined in or that efforts be made to limit the exercise of its authority that we currently see it, that private sector actors like developers should be free to do whatever they want to do. I'm saying that instead of a prescriptive permit-based micromanaging means and method, paper-intensive, procedure-intensive intensive process like we have now, that people, private sector actors, like developers and factory owners, be given a set through congressional action and perhaps limited regulatory rulemaking, be given a set of rules, prohibitions, limits, clearly defined prohibitions on their activities. No emissions that exceed X parts per million, no structure taller than 75 feet. Prohibitions, outer limits, clearly defined. But within those limits, they be left as free as possible to pursue whatever their activities and goals are. If, on the other hand, efforts are made to free up the current logjam by reducing the details and regulations and leaving the regulator free to act, free to apply his or her personal judgment to a particular fact situation and just look at a nursing home, to use Philip's example, and determine whether it has a home-like setting, raises a risk. It's a potential recipe for further administrative abuse, because the regulator is not just dealing within the context of a regime defined by detail. The regime is defined by an overall orientation toward permissions, permits, and then inspections, audits, reports to be filed, and the rest, all of which are backed by serious monetary and sometimes criminal sanctions. So the regulators, the whole regulatory scheme is characterized by a system that gives the regulator enormous amounts of discretion now, and they can punish severely the regulated party. Yes, it's true that the complexity itself creates a certain kind of discretion because there's no clear standard to judge the decisions that they make, and there's certainly not effective congressional or judicial review or checks on the activity. They're virtually unaccountable, not only to administer but to create the rules in the first place. Well, in a recent year, I think it was 2014, Congress passed 224 statutes, and the federal agencies in the same time period enacted 3,554 final rules. And that doesn't even count guidance and FAQs and website posts and Dear Colleague letters. So there's a lot of discretion already, and if the approach to the current problem is a simplification that increases regulator discretion to apply general principles and make determinations like the compliance of a nursing home with the principle of and requirement of creating a home-like setting. If you simplify things in that way and leave in place everything else, the need for permits and the power and the punishments that could be brought to bear on the regulated party, I think it's hard for me anyway to see how that would improve things. It would undermine the last vestige of accountability and increase cronyism, which is a big problem already. Philip has correctly noted that it is, and I agree with him. But cronyism, by its definition, is you know, seeking favors and making payments and trying to give the person in authority some reason to grant you the permission that you need. If you just free up the system more and leave, again, all the powers in place and say that all the regulator has to do is determine whether I have a home-like setting, I have created a home-like setting, I think I'll be more likely to be an abused private sector actor than now. I don't think that's the answer.
All right, let's check in with the audience. Before we do that, I'm going to make an announcement about upcoming calls. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about the right to try. That's America's drug approval regime and the right to try medicines that are not yet approved. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. On Friday, also at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about intellectual property cases in the Supreme Court. Today, of course, we're talking to Philip K. Howard and Ken Davis. Let's take our first call of the day.
Yeah, thank you. I must say I think I agree more with Mr. Davis than Mr. Howard. Both have good points, but I would even take it a step further, maybe a little bit more clear. And I've been practicing law here in Washington for almost 30 years, and nothing is more apparent than what really has to happen is not more rules. More rules actually reduce the rule of law because, like you said, when you've got 900 pages of regulations, nobody can figure it out, and that actually does give more discretion to the regulatory agency. I mean, I've got clients that suffered hugely just because one assistant secretary was replaced and sees something different. And on the flip side, general concepts, I think, would be a real disaster because then you're even more at the whims of a political opponent or somebody who disagrees with you and enter more judgment. What really has to happen is the power has to be taken away. You know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, it was easier and it was quicker to get stuff done. People say, well, we had pollution, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, maybe. But you know, all of these fixes that are being talked about, without taking the power of the regulatory state away, nothing's going to get fixed. I mean, a general concept's not going to fix it, and passing more specific rules is not going to fix it because the specific rules don't mean anything when the courts have been completely willing to say, well, you have executive branch discretion. So, you know, you see friends, I see companies that donate to the right people that use the right, you know, no offense to any firms on the phone here, but to use the right politically connected law firms do a lot better depending on what administration, what age, you know, assistant secretary or SES level person you're dealing with in the government. So the solution, I'd just like to hear what people think about the solution really isn't more specificity or more generality. It's taking away the power.
Well, this is Philip. First of all, I think the problem of official discretion, official abuse is a serious problem. And as Ken suggested, there's no accountability. So, you know, in my world, and I write about this every time I write about it, officials have to be fireable. You know, we have to change the civil service. It's just crazy. You can't let have any form of responsibility unless there's accountability, and we have no accountability. My problem with the position both that the caller just had and also with Ken's is that I think they're imagining a world where you've got a clear rule, and you can imagine a height limit or an effluent guideline. That's a clear rule, and that's fine. But for things involving human activities, you know, whether something is an adequate daycare center, for example, or a nursing home or the like, clear metrics have almost nothing to do whether they're adequate. So we could just get government out of the business and let the people in nursing homes take care of themselves, although over half of them suffer from dementia. Or we can have some measure of government oversight. My view of government oversight is it hovers further away than specific rules. People don't go in with a checklist and write out tickets, which is what they do with OSHA and nursing homes and such right now. They're responding to broader goals. But it does give a measure of, I'll call it discretion. It's not real discretion because it's subject to oversight. But you know, judgment by someone who could abuse it, And so, yeah, that's a problem. But the current system is, as the caller just suggested, is a disaster because it makes the studies of regulation in nursing homes show that the regulation makes nursing homes worse because people spend their, there's a huge opportunity cost. It's like environmental review. People spend their time complying rather than making life nice for Mrs. Jones. So as I, unless I'm missing something, I think both the caller and Ken are suggesting that in areas that always boil down to human judgment, like what's a nice nursing home or what's a good school for that matter, we just get government out of the business. And maybe you could get half the people in the country to vote for that, but I don't think so.
Well, this is Ken, if I might briefly respond. Yes, I think the caller makes a very important related point. It's not a just a process matter. It's a or even level of detail or number of pages. It's the reducing the power, reducing the, if you will, the scope of activities that the regulator is expected to engage in. Now Philip says, all right, you imagine a certain limited list of physical criteria that must be met by a nursing home, but then what do you do about the human factors, the quality factors? Well, I think the answer to that question is that within a system that is characterized by the rule, traditional concepts of the rule of law, you have nursing homes that operate and they meet all the basic clear bright line criteria, and then they compete on quality. And people can gather information through a variety of channels, and they can decide for themselves who has the best home-like setting. We have done so many things to undermine the decision-making capabilities of individual consumers through third-party payment systems and all the rest that the nursing home operator ends up responding to the regulator and not the customer. But the answer or what happens when you take away the regulator, it's not nothing. In a rule of law system, it's the market, and they compete. The notion that the regulator is somehow in a position to make these decisions and come to these judgments about quality and human conditions and what's a home-like atmosphere, it really is traceable, all of it, back to the late 19th century Wilsonian progressive concept of the expert. Someone who, a class of people who in a complex, developing, industrializing society, the America that confronted the progressives at the turn of the 20th century, someone who was just better educated and somehow better situated to make better choices about complex matters than individuals. And all the means and methods, micromanagement and complexity, it is all traceable back to that mistaken concept, what Friedrich Hayek called the fatal conceit, that somehow there's a class of bureaucratic administrators who are in a position, because of their superior knowledge, capabilities, et cetera, to make better decisions than individuals can in a free setting characterized by the rule of law. So it's that we don't need experts to ensure that there's a home-like setting if we have the rule of law in a competitive market economy.
You know, I'm no, as Philip, I'm no fan of experts. Whenever I'm around experts, I get I get a rash. But we live in a very crowded, interdependent world where if we didn't have government oversight on a variety of things, our freedom would be dramatically diminished because we would be defensive in choosing, for example, what pharmaceuticals might be good, or in worrying about whether the toy had lead paint on it, or whether the water is clean, or the like, and or whether airplanes are safe. And all of those judgments, particularly, I have a lot of problems with the way FDA is doing its job, but I don't want to do away with the FDA and expert opinions. I think the FAA does a pretty good job of deciding which planes are airworthy, and I don't want the market to decide that because I don't want to be on one of those planes that the market ultimately determines isn't any good. So, I think we're kind of stuck in an interdependent world with people, with there being kind of sort of red lights and green lights about what's kind of minimum quality that's acceptable, so you and I don't have to worry about it. And so that's my concern about this topic. We can argue about whether nursing homes or other kinds of establishments should be, could be better regulated by the market, and I'm all for the market. But there are certain oversight the government does that enhances our freedom in a variety of ways, and they involve the judgment of experts.
I don't disagree with that general principle, and I don't disagree with the concept that people expert in a certain discipline have something to add, but it's the mechanism by which expert opinion is brought to bear on a complex society that is centralized and outmoded, and especially dangerous when it's coupled with the power of people who are supposed experts, supposedly apolitical, who not only are charged with exercising their professional judgment, but they have the authority to permit or prohibit and punish, and they have the discretion that we've been talking about before, and the resulting abuses are known to all through the sadly recurring news report. Certainly things are more complex today than they were in 1776, but that doesn't mean that our regulatory system has to be one based on 19th century notions of information flow and bureaucratic administrative models inherited from Bismarck's Germany. Richard Epstein, Philip Hamburger, and a lot of other people have written, I think compellingly, that simple basic rules are more important the more complex things become in society. And what I'm saying is we need to keep in mind traditional concepts of the rule of law and our founding principles, and revisit our concerns about health and safety and the environment, and look at traditional legal mechanisms like property and trespass and contract and nuisance, and do all of that. Yes, in our current 21st century environment, our context characterized by exploding technology and communications, distributed computing, digital communications, internet, social media, embedded dispersed microsensors, distributed ledgers, open source modeling. AEI just announced a program yesterday, I think it was, that they're setting up an open source modeling that will allow people, experts, if you will, all over the country to kind of shadow track some of the analysis that's currently locked up in a black box at federal regulatory agencies and question it. It's not that we don't need experts. It's that we need to get away from, again, the 19th century outdated progressive concept that the experts we look to in society are the ones sitting in the District of Columbia, also possessing power to permit and to punish.
We do have another question in our audience, just one though. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
I was wondering if how familiar the panelists were with Charles Murray's recent proposal to rein in the administrative state, or probably the greatest excesses of the administrative state, with lawfare, basically to bring the mechanisms of the administrative state to a grinding halt through lawsuits and injunctions and so forth. His main contention is that it simply will not be stopped by Congress or by the Supreme Court. And I just find fascinating that the one, you know, sort of bizarre example where this worked was during the 90s with the Scientologists. They wanted their religious identification with the IRS. And they brought every IRS official into court that they could all over the country for years, until the IRS finally relented and gave them their religious status. So I just wondered, you know, I know that's very specific, but I just wondered if either of them was familiar with that, with Charles Murray's proposal on that.
Yes, this is Philip. I've talked with Charles. You know, the book is, he asked me not to sue him for plagiarism because he basically used all kinds of stories from my books to write his book. Well, you know, I don't know if I certainly wouldn't advocate what he's saying, but first of all, history shows that any entrenched system never changes without a kind of revolution, you know, a crisis or something. So change doesn't happen incrementally; it happens in big gulps. I mean, that was true in the 1960s, true in the 1930s with the Depression, true with the Progressive Era when they finally sort of overthrew laissez-faire and did the sort of thing that Ken doesn't like. It was true with abolition, you know. So, so in this country, it's true as well as in every other country. So, I think, and Charles is completely correct that if you use all the mechanisms in the current legal system, everything will grind to a halt immediately. It's just, and Ken and I completely agree on this. I mean, you couldn't possibly, you know, comply with all the rules. You can sue over, you know, anybody who doesn't do, you know, hindsight bias is perfect, right? I would have been happier if you hadn't made this decision or this accident wouldn't have happened or whatever. So, so he's absolutely right that you could make everything, the current system is one of the, you know, one of the many forms of proof of the absurdity of the current system is that. But I would, you know, Ken called for simple rules. Simple rules are generally, there are some clear rules like height limits and speed limits, but by and large, what people consider to be simple rules, free speech, freedom of speech, unreasonable search and seizures, are rules and that are tied to social norms and principles. And so in the execution of the rule, someone is allowed to use their judgment about whether this is an unreasonably dangerous behavior or whatever. And in our system of law, that those general principles can be given meaning by, you know, case by case decisions or whatever. But I would basically argue that certainly for any matter of complexity, there's no such thing as a simple rule without human judgment. And if you try to eliminate human judgment, you end up with 950 pages. So, you know, and Wittgenstein wrote all about this, and basically every form of words creates a new level of ambiguity. And it's just in the nature of language. So
Ken Davis, do you have a...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, to I want to respond to the questioner, but first to take Philip's last point about simple rules. Again, I think it's very important to distinguish between rules of prohibition and rules of prescription. Yes, it's difficult, if and indeed impossible, to come up with simple rules of prescription because situations are complex and you have to exercise human judgment. But I'm saying the person to exercise the judgment, the individual judgment, is the regulated entity, not the regulator, and to be free to deal with all of the undoubted countless complexities that confront individuals on a daily basis. But we used to be much more a nation characterized by a system of laws where individuals were free to do that within very, very broad parameters defined by simple prohibitions. The answer was, how do you figure out all the complex things within the prohibitions? Who's going to decide that? The only person to decide it is the only person who's really the effective expert, and that's the individual dealing with their own circumstances. Now, as to Charles Murray and Lawfare and his recent book about civil disobedience, I think resistance litigation, and that's really my paraphrase, is an understandable concept, but it pretty quickly runs up against I think real world constraints defined by resources and personal exposure. I mean, we are so much a society, unfortunately, characterized by everyone having a need for permits and everyone subject to the next audit or next inspection or the next decision about whether to continue funding your college or whatever your research organization. We are so dependent on the step-by-step, day-by-day favorable decisions of regulators. It's difficult to imagine that there would be enough individuals who would have the inclination and the resources to pursue the kind of sand in the gears litigation that Charles Murray is talking about. Now, certainly, any other change is very difficult. I think traditional sources of reform that are associated with our traditional separation of powers, congressional oversight, legal court review, there's not much hope there for change. And there is, by analogy, some very interesting work that's been done by Douglas North, the Nobel economist who's focused on developing economies and what it takes to develop, what it takes for a society and an economy to move from kind of pre-developed to developed status. And it's useful to think of his writings by analogy and application to our own situation, because every economy is still developing. And he makes the point that of course, this is only the kind of common sense point that a Nobel economist can make, but things are the way they are because of the interests of the people in the society with the power to change them if they decide to change them, but they are happy with the way things are. And every consideration of the administrative state and our regulatory problems, all the costs and everything else that we've talked about on this call and read about from time to time, and all the proposals for reform, have to recognize the fact, I think, that so many of the people who have the social and political and economic power to change things fundamentally, if they would, have in many, many cases a vested interest in a continuation of the current situation. Complexity, we talk about regulatory complexity, the stifling, impenetrable complexity of the regulatory state. Complexity has made many, many careers in this country, professional careers in the government and academics and law and economics and consulting and on and on. And until and unless some critical mass of people with the power to change things can envision a next step, a different state that should be moved to, it won't be. And the only thing that will trigger, as Philip said, otherwise trigger a fundamental change, is a real crisis, a functional, absolute functional breakdown in the present situation that would force people with the power to change things to change things.
We've got a few minutes left. We have what looks to be a final question, so let's turn now to our final question of the day.
Hi, this is Tony Cotto with the NAIC. So, you know, in full disclosure, I do represent regulators, but of a sort of different variety. I was intrigued by the comment about, you know, supposed experts in Washington. I'm actually interested in the panelists' thoughts on experts at the state level, because our experience has largely been that while regulators in D.C. tend to have this culture of stifling innovation, at the state level, innovation's really encouraged. And I'm just wondering if the folks on the call have any sort of comments on how we can shift the paradigm back to the states and take regulatory power away from D.C.
Yeah, that's interesting, Philip. First of all, I agree with a lot of what Ken just said about the culture and self-interest and such. I think one of the biggest problems we have with this current system, although Ken and I disagree on the solution, is that it really needs to get remade, and it does need to get radically simplified. And the people inside the system are not going to do it, because everybody's doing really well just being on a perpetual, you know, hamster wheel, you know, in Washington. So, and I agree with this caller. I do think that there's more innovation. The closer you get to the ground, the better government works, because real people are affected by decisions, and they put pressure on the mayor or, to a certain extent, on the governor, and they want to try things out for themselves. So I do think there needs to be, as much as possible, more in a radical simplification mode, more responsibility shifted downward.
I agree with that. We've had a few examples over the decades, block grants of certain to fund certain programs and shift greater responsibility for the administrative details to states, but the examples have been limited for the unfortunate but obvious and very difficult to modify factor that the federal government wants to hold power. Any entity or organization that possesses power wants to expand it and at least hold it. So it will take a great deal of strategic and tactical thought to try to think about opportunities for meaningful devolution. But I agree with Philip, and that the closer to the facts and circumstances of a particular situation, that is where the decision should always be placed. And that's the point I've tried to make in earlier comments during this call. And the states are certainly closer to their own particular fact situations, circumstances, needs, and resources than the federal government. And they're more likely to be responsive to the individuals affected by the decision. So it's the devolution from federal to the state level is certainly consistent with the broader point, ultimate point made by Hayek, that the decision maker, the best expert, is the one who is closest to the situation, has that immediate information, and will enjoy the benefits or suffer the consequences of the decision made.
Looks like we might have a final question. I'll ask our caller to be as brief as possible and see if we can squeeze in this last question.
I've got to disagree with the speaker who said that he thinks the FDA is a necessity. I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing you can do with consumer information, and the FDA seems to have been captured by the large drug companies that it regulates, and they tend to exclude natural remedies while they promote dangerous things like antidepressants and vaccines, and do not provide regulation for that while they try to regulate out natural remedies.
Well, this is Philip. I'm the person who said it, and I guess I just disagree with you. I mean, I think there's a lot of room for improvement there, but I think vaccines are pretty good, and somebody's got to decide whether we're going to have a vaccination regime or not for sort of obvious reasons. So, you know, that's just the difference in point of view, I think.
We've got a couple minutes left. I'm going to revert to each of you for a final thought or a last statement before we adjourn. Why don't we go in the order we began? Mr. Howard.
Well, I think, just briefly, I think it's really important to focus on what we want, you know, out of government, and for government to try to be practical and to enhance people's freedom. That's the ultimate goal of law and government. And I don't think it does that now, and I think Ken and I agree that it doesn't. And then the question is, what's the solution? I'm not for unfettered power by people, but all my work shows me that for areas where there must be government oversight, and we might disagree on that, giving officials a measure of discretion to use their common sense will also liberate the person on the ground to use their common sense, and if there is a disagreement, to argue over right and wrong rather than legal parsing. And that's a better system, in my view, than a system that's either no regulation at all or this horrible system we have now with 150 million words of federal regulation that nobody can understand.
Ken Davis?
I'm certainly not advocating for no regulation, but only a return for the rule of law, and certainly that will include an appropriate amount of administrative discretion in the application of prohibitions to particular fact situations. But that's way far away from where we are now and the virtually unfettered, unaccountable exercise of abusive discretion.
Well, gentlemen, this has been extremely informative. I want to thank you both, Mr. Kennerly Davis, Mr. Philip K. Howard. We certainly appreciate your time and your thoughtful remarks today. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about the right to try in the America's drug approval regime, the FDA. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.